So if you hear this and you live in Edmonton and you have a time machine.
Exactly. I know. I'm sorry. I'm dropping it like it's promo.
Podcast for the website nerdappropriate.com. This is episode number 122. We are down a member, but we have a very special guest, Kelly Wallach from the Indie Mega Booth, the Overlord. Yeah.
The Overlord.
She has a fucking incredible story, I just have to say. Like her
dropping F bombs.
Dropping F bombs. Yeah, sorry. We're explicit for a reason.
Yeah,
but anyway, no. She was a lot of fun. She gave a lot of really insightful information, and I just told her a second ago that her drive to make the Mega Booth big and exciting is really selfless. Like she's doing it because she loves games and she loves seeing creative people kind of band together.
Yeah.
And loves the sense of community. So I think you guys will really like this chat that we had with her just about gaming in general.
And we should say the member we are down is Scott. He is out, which is rare. I was thinking about this. I don't know that Scott has missed a podcast in a very long time. But he is currently building a robot to take over the world with.
Whoa.
So welcome, Scott, soon to be your world overlord, right?
Yeah.
I'm glad that we're friends.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm hoping it means he won't crush me underneath the foot of the heel of his gigantic robot.
Or he could go for us first because of all the years of teasing.
Probably.
Yeah.
It was a solid.
I'm going to say he's going to go after you guys first.
Yeah, probably. Yeah,
probably me first. Let's just be honest, guys.
Yeah. Yeah, you do pick on him the most.
All right. Well, enjoy this talk with Kelly Wallach, and we'll be back.
All right, we are here with Kelly Wallach, and this is episode 122 of the Rated NA podcast, and we're here to talk about indie gaming and the Indie Mega Booth. So, Kelly, thank you so much for coming by and hanging out.
Yeah, thanks for the invite.
Yeah, it's awesome. So we're obviously big fans of the Mega Booth, and we got a chance to chat a little bit this year at PAX Prime mm-hmm. in Seattle, and it was really, I think, I had seen you speak before at East. You had a panel at East this year, I think, and I saw the panel and I became kind of interested in you know everything the Mega Booth was doing, and then this year you and I were on a panel together at Prime and we talked a little bit and I was like, I need to have you on because your story is really interesting and what you're doing is really interesting, and then when I saw how the indie developers treated you on the floor, it was insane. It was like you were like honestly, it was, I mean, you're gonna disagree here, but you were like a little bit of a beetle. Like everywhere you went, everyone like ran up to you and like hugged you, and like I was just like, wow. Like, and then I realized that you were making a huge difference in a lot of these people's lives. So before we start talking about the booth and before I just rant endlessly, let's talk a little bit about your background and kind of how you got into this whole scene, so to speak. So how did this all begin for you? And while I think a couple of us at the site know the answer to this, this is, you know, also for our listeners who have no clue. So
yeah, of course. So I'll give the medium length version of the story, because the long version can, I think, be pretty long. So let's see, I'll backtrack until I moved to Boston. So I used to be in the sciences. I actually went to college for chemistry. So I have a degree in chemistry, and that was my thing.
That's
and right out of college, yeah, it's totally related, don't worry. So right out of college, I was working at a startup company, this nanotechnology company at Penn State. That's where I went to school at. And it was like a small business incubator. And I was working there because I had a choice between two different jobs, one where I went in, it was like this big pharmaceutical company or, you know, tech company, and they handed me this sheet of paper and they're like, hey, can you just do these experiments, you know, like all all day, every day when you come in. And, you know, I'm looking at this paper and being like, I just went to college. Like, yeah, I can read instructions and like do this for you. and then I interviewed at this startup where they were like, we need you to do 8 million things and we need you to help with OSHA requirements and you're going to have to do experiment design and you're going to do this and like, you know, maybe you'll do some accounting stuff. And it just sounded more like I was going to get more experience even though the pay wasn't going to be so great. And that sort of started where I was always working at startups or always, you know, taking jobs that were going to be more interesting or I was going to be learning more things at. I was there for maybe a year or so, and then we're starting to run out of funding, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to stay in state college anymore. And I was going to like move out of the country. I wanted to move to France because I had watched a documentary about something with Europe. I don't know.
Sometimes that's all it takes.
I think it is. Thanks.
A really good documentary. You're like, I'm going to move to France.
Yeah, they looked like they were really happy, and everyone's like hanging out, and I was just. Anyway, so I was looking into that, and then and I had always wanted to go to MIT, like to go to college there, because you know that's obviously like a really prestigious school, and there's a lot of cool stuff going on. So I'd applied for a position there as a way to try and motivate myself, I guess, to go to grad school and try and go to grad school at MIT. So I ended up getting the job, moved to Boston, and Boston's great. I'm still living here now. And do you guys know about the lab explosion?
No, I don't know about the lab explosion.
So then my lab exploded. Everybody was fine.
Wait, hold on a second. Wait. There has to be back more up. Of this story.
And then my lab exploded.
I want to know this one requires details. I want to hear about particular shards of glass flying and everything.
I really like that you're like, did you hear about the lab explosion? And we're like, no. And you're like, well, then my lab exploded. And then you just move forward.
Well, that's the boring part. We'll just skip that. No. It was not my fault. It was so MIT is an old university, and a lot of the heating systems are run by steam pipes. So you like run steam lines, you know, and they have radiators and things like that to heat the campus. And we were in the sub basement in one of the buildings, and it had a huge mechanical room across from where our lab was, which had a lot of this like infrastructure for the pipelines and things like that. And the facilities, the maintenance people were doing some sort of testing, and they shut off the steam pipe. And so what happens is when you shut off the steam, all the water condenses. And then when you turn back on the steam line, it's called a water hammer effect, where the steam hits the cold condensed water and it can blow the pipes open. And so what they have is they have flex joints and you know periodically in the pipes to collect the condensation and then to hopefully absorb the impact from this happening, which didn't happen in this case. It just blew the pipe open. So thankfully nobody was there, because the steam explosions are actually very dangerous, and it was a 8-inch main steam pipe.
Do you realize you're telling a superhero origin story, and this is how you became the overlord, right? So there's this explosion in the lab, and then
I became radioactive,
and then you're reborn as the indie mega booth overlord.
It's like the Terminator style. Like I just sort of like there's like clouds and stuff around.
Yeah,
it was crazy. It melted the tar on the roof. The building got so hot. Like from the sub basement up to like the third or fourth floor. So the lab was basically unusable after this, and it was like insurance claims, and the whole thing was just sort of disastrous. And working in academia, I mean, it was awesome and I love the job, but it pays terribly. Like when you work in an academic institution, like you're not rolling in the big bucks. Like that's not what happens there.
I'm secretly a history teacher, so I know your pain.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you feel my pain on that.
I worked at a university before moving to New York, so
it's funny because when I first moved and I was getting the job, my advisor at Penn State he gave me the best piece of advice. He's like, there's more politics in academia than there is in politics.
Oh, that's so true.
It took me a little bit to figure out that was the case, but it's totally the case. There's so much internal politics in academia, and like it's a lifestyle. It's like that's a choice that you make, and you do that, you know, like that you stay in that academic system. So I chose not to, and went and worked for a biofuel company that was funding research while we were rebuilding the lab.
Okay.
And that was a startup. I was their fourth employee. I ordered all their equipment. We designed the infrastructure for the lab. You know, I made all their processes on patents and, you know, this whole thing with this company. And I realized I didn't really like doing doing the science stuff anymore. It was like so much work. I just, if you don't go for like, you know, getting your thesis, you know, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't go and you get a PhD mm-hmm. and a postdoc and all this, it's actually really hard to get anywhere in the sciences, no matter what you're doing. Like even me trying to do it in this sort of roundabout, you know, working at startups or working in academia and getting all this experience, like more experience than people that were hiring that were postdocs, like it didn't really matter because on paper, you know, I hadn't gone to school for like 10 or 15 years for this.
Yeah.
And so at that time, my sister was moving from California back into Boston, and she was working at Lockheed Martin on satellite programming. And I was saying that I wanted to start a company, like my own company, because I was tired of working for other people, and I was going to start this biotech company. And she was like, well, I want to not work for other people. And she's like, but I want to make video games instead of doing satellite programming. And I thought that sounded cool. And like, we had always played video games as kids and stuff like that. And I never really thought of it as something that people did. I mean, I knew people made video games, obviously, but it never dawned on me that, you know, somebody was actually doing that as a job. And we went to PAX just as fans. I guess this was like 3 years ago. It was the very first PAX East when they still had it in the Heinz Convention Center.
Yeah.
Was that 3 years ago?
That was three, yeah. Because our first East was the year after that, the first year in the new convention center. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so we went to that just as fans, and I was trying to help her find a startup video game company for her to get a job at, because I was like, you know, I had always worked at startups as a way to get my foot in the door. I was like, the pay is going to be terrible. You're going to have to do a million things, but it'll be a good experience, and you'll get, you know, your foot in the door in the industry. So we went to PAX, and we tried to find startup video game companies. And one of the first companies that we came up against was actually Firehose Games. Yeah. So that was the very first time that, you know, I had done anything with video game stuff. And then Adriel, my sister, she had started going to local Boston meetups, and I was coming out and meeting more people. And eventually I decided to make the switch into working in the games industry by working at Infrared 5, which is a local, like a service-based company where, you know, they make games and they make technical applications and things like that. And during that time, I was also helping out Firehose at their booth spaces at PAX and things like that, and, you know, going to the booth and helping out. And we were at PAX Prime, I think it might have been a year or so after that, the first time that they opened up the sixth floor. And the difference in traffic was just crazy. Like, there was basically nobody was coming up to the sixth floor. Nobody really knew it was there. Mm-hmm. Once they were up there, like, Notch was up there, and he was, I think they just announced Scrolls. I don't know if it's still called that, but I don't know how that actually turned out. But so people were coming up there, and, you know, they were coming to look at Notch and at the game and everything, but then everything else was just sort of like, what's all this stuff up here?
Yeah, the sixth floor was crazy this year. It was huge. I mean, this year was nuts.
Yeah, it was much. The traffic has increased a lot. And this was, so it wasn't like, I don't know. I don't want to say it was like a terrible thing that they put all the indie developers up on this floor that they didn't know how it was going to sell. But it was also sort of disappointing because you put all this work, you know, for months and months to make builds and to get games ready. And then you're mm-hmm. spending a bunch of money mm-hmm. and you're flying out there and you're like making press appointments, and then you get there and there's like not really anybody coming to see your space.
Yeah. That must be really frustrating for people.
Yeah. And there were a bunch of us up there. There were maybe like a dozen or more indie companies, or at the time it was sort of referred to as Indie Alley at PAX, where they would have all the indie developers, and they would do the same thing at East too. Like, they would just have a row of 10 by 10s that small developers could buy. And so Eitan then had the idea that he was like, you know, we're based in Boston. We know all these developers in Boston. When we do PAX East, we should just get a huge group of our friends together and we'll buy a big space on the actual show floor, you know, like the main floor space. And then that way people will have to come and see us, and we'll be able to bargain basically better with Penny Arcade to be able to get good locations for indie developers.
Yeah.
And the idea was great. We sort of joked about it a little bit. And at the time I was either just starting to get in the games industry or I was just thinking of switching, and I didn't really know too many people. So I was like, if you can convince people to do this, like, I'll run the logistics for you, because I'm super organized and I like to make lists. And it's like this joke where I'm like obsessed with spreadsheets and lists, and like, you know, that's my thing. And so I figured it would be fun. I could meet people. You know, I could do something really, really, really interesting with the community. And so then that first PAX East, Eitan worked with the Penny Arcade people and the organizers for the conference, and they were really receptive the idea, which is great. I've found out later that now that we're starting to talk with more conference organizers and we're looking to expand into other places, Penny Arcade really does something interesting with PAX where they let people who haven't shown at conferences before buy space, which sounds like it wouldn't be all that exciting, but mm-hmm. some of these other conferences, mm-hmm. people have years worth of contracts and you can't ever even have an option to buy a space mm-hmm. at certain conferences unless mm-hmm. like you're a big company or you have some sort of like longstanding relationship with them. Mm-hmm. And that's one mm-hmm. of the things that they want to do with PAX is to make it more accessible to people. And by doing that, you know, then they started to focus on stuff for indies, like having the PAX 10 and the Boston Indie Showcase and mm-hmm. things like that. And they're really, mm-hmm. they're very, very supportive of the indie scene, even before it was really a thing as much as it is now. Yeah. And so without yeah. them giving us that chance to do this, like none of this would have ever happened. And they still work with us, like, you know, on helping out with logistics and helping to negotiate pricing and things like that. And they've just been so accommodating for all these sort of crazy, weird ideas that we come up with and that
also,
we want.
It's also risky for them as well, because if the games that are on the floor aren't well received, then people are going to be like, oh, you know, this year's PAX wasn't good because of the games that we're showing there. But the games have just been getting more and more incredible. And that's, you know, just a testament to how creative everyone's getting in gaming right now. So.
Yeah, we sort of, looking back at it and knowing now the types of people that we were working with the first time around, we were really lucky in a sense. I mean, we had Alex Bruce was in the first one with Annie Chamber, Cappy, Nathan Bella, who helped out a ton. Monaco was in the first one. Like, we had all these really sort of, like, heavy hitter indies helping us out the very first time that we did this without, like, and at the time I had no idea who any of these people were. Yeah. And they really helped to shape, that. And then when it went well the first time, it was basically becoming a word of mouth thing where then they were telling their friends, hey, this went well, we got more traffic, it was a better way to show at the conference. Mm-hmm. And so up until just mm-hmm. this very past time, it was all word of mouth and we didn't really curate, and it just happened that we were just getting recommendations from people who had really cool things going on, and there's so much neat stuff going on in the indie scene that we sort of benefited from just being like happening to work with all these amazing indie developers the first time around.
That's really, so how scary was it for you? Cause you just announced this year that you're doing this full time now. And this is your thing. How scary was it to kind of, to just do Megabooth full time? Was it, I mean, I know a lot of people that kind of have to give up their day jobs in order to, you know, kind of pursue their passion. So what was that like for you?
It was sort of scary, but it was also a relief in a way, because I'd been essentially working two jobs for months at that point, because I was still working full-time at Infrared 5, and you know, they're supportive of me working on the Megabooth stuff, but I still had to do my like job all the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was going to work and then coming home and working from like, you know, 7 o'clock until like 1 or 2 in the morning for like, you know, weeks and weeks on end, and then working full weekends and all this other stuff. And then PAX East ended up going really well for us. And I went to GDC for the first time directly after that. And I was meeting all these developers, and I know you're joking about the Beatles thing. I don't know if I'm quite at the, I'm not quite at the Beatles.
Maybe Ringo level Beatle. Is that acceptable?
Was it John Lennon who had that famous quote, like, we're bigger than Jesus or something.
Yeah.
I could say that. Ridiculous controversy. I think what he was referencing was that they had sold more records than the Bible had sold that year or something. Total. Like, he was actually technically correct in whatever he was saying. It just came off as, you know, completely obnoxious.
When it became a poll quote, it was like, oh, you know, he just said he's bigger than Jesus. And you're like, well, he might not have intended that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I was meeting all these developers who I hadn't met before. And, you know, people knew what we were doing and knew what we were working on and were really excited about it. And I went back, I think, and quit like 3 days later. Like, it was one of those now or never type of things. Like I'm never going to be in a situation to have an opportunity like this again. You know, it was really taking off. I'm really enjoying what I'm doing. The developers love it. Like, I've been talking to people about ways to make it financially viable. And I didn't really have like a totally set plan, but I had a good idea that like there was something that I could do, to make this as like a thing that I could do full time. And so taking a leap was actually, it was like really sort of a relief and a bit scary in the sense of like, I'd never really worked for myself before, even though I'd always worked at startups and stuff like that. Like, I was never the sole, you know, person that I was being responsible to. Mm-hmm. But and I feel really lucky at this point because it's not, I don't know, I don't think you get many opportunities in your life to do something as a job, especially that just you enjoy and that makes you happy and feels fulfilling. Yeah. Yeah. And not everyone has that, you know?
Yeah.
Like there's days where I'm exhausted and I'm not sure why I'm doing this. And, you know, I'm like in my head, like, oh God, what have I gotten myself into? But then, you know, 90% of the other time I'm waking up every morning and I'm excited about what I'm doing. And I love the people that I work with. And like, it's so rewarding after months and months of working. And we all work remotely and everything too. And you finally see all these people and you meet them. And that's why that atmosphere happens at PAX, is because it's really the first time that we're all together.
Yeah, it's like
room.
A big party. We feel the same way. Like, yeah. We've been going to PAX for, I don't know,
3 years.
About two or three years. But it's the same thing. When we show up and we get to talk to people in person that we've had on the show and just like listeners and devs that we love. And it is like a big party. And like you're saying, like every time we all of us come back from PAX, we're like, we need to find a way to just like do this to feel that way, because it is like kind of, I mean, not to sound cheesy, but it is like a magical feeling of community and just like you're immersed in creativity, and it's such a amazing feeling that, you know, it's awesome that you were able to, you know, to do that full time, and that's great that you were brave enough to do it.
It seems like Boston has a really tight-knit, especially gaming community, like from what I've gathered just from being around, you know, Sean and other people, it seems like, oh yeah, I know that guy. Yeah, I know that. Oh yeah, we're all friends. Yeah, he's working on this. That guy's doing this thing. And it's like, part of that is Sean, definitely. But the other part is, it just seems like Boston's very tight-knit. And do you feel that way about Boston? And do you also think it's translating into the indie game community? Because it seems like the Mega Booth definitely kind of brings that group together in that sort of way.
Yeah, I mean, Boston community is one of the reasons that I even got into the games industry in the first place, because everybody here is so welcoming. And we have Boston Postmortem, we have Boston Indies, there's a Boston Unity user group. And if you go there and you ask people questions, I mean, you get honest, actual answers. And everybody is really helpful, and they just want people to be involved in the gaming community and to, you know, if that's their passion, they want to help people pursue it. And there's a lot of really great people, like Ichiro from Dejabon and Rohit. Like, they helped out a ton with the Mega Booth, and Ichiro is still sort of someone I bug for advice constantly. And there's a lot of really great things that are going on. Just, we have the Indie Game Collective, which is a co-op working space, which are sort of popping up in other communities as well. And it's neat because there's starting to be a bit... The indie scene is fragmented in this way, where it's not because people don't want to talk to each other or they, you know, don't want to associate with other indie developers. It's just that it's fragmented because there's no big infrastructure. It's and essential. So you get these little, you get these pockets in different cities where people are building a community and they're trying to find other developers. And then, you know, from the Megaboost perspective, we're trying to build a more like national and global community where all of these, you know, little pockets of developers from all over the world can come and work together, and we can help to have that infrastructure for them. Like, we can help to connect them with other people or help them to do paperwork or to find somebody to freelance for them or something, you know. And having that community is so important as an indie developer, because you just, I mean, otherwise you're just sort of out in the ocean by yourself, you know, flailing around. Oh, and definitely. Like, you don't have a big corporate infrastructure. So you like, you need this. And it's also, it's taxing. It's emotionally taxing. It's financially taxing. You know, you're working for months and months and months and your head's down and you're dumping all of your personal money into something, and this is like, these are passion projects, and if you don't have the emotional support, you know, along the way, you can just sort of fall apart and you can get really lost in it. So there are people that even do like the conference circuit, where you set it as a milestone and then you come to these things and you feel sort of like drained, and then you get re-energized by seeing all these people and seeing all this creative stuff and having other people to commiserate with, like, oh God, you know, I haven't slept in like 3 days and my build isn't working and like, I don't have any money left. Good. And everyone's like, yeah, me too. And
then,
like,
you can all get a beer. Big sense of community. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, it's super, super important. And so I really love the feel that we've been able to create with the Mega Booth area in general, like you're saying, the sort of like festival feel, and where people come and they feel welcome and they feel like they're having a good time. And it's like, it rejuvenates you to go back and you're re-energized to sort of like do heads down and do it, you know, until the next one. And we even have people that if they don't show a game, they just come and they volunteer just because they want to be around and they want to hang out with people and they want to, you know, see the new games that are coming out and stuff like that. And it's just like, I just love that we've been able to create that within the indie community and bring sort of the feeling that we have in cities like Boston, or I know Chicago and Austin have really big scenes, and expand that into national and local situations.
It seems like there's a magical mix between a city being small enough to easily create a community like that, but also yet big enough to support a community. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
because New York is gigantic. It's enormous. You get lost in it really easily. The communities are there, but they're usually really tiny, like pocketed communities, like in Brooklyn or in Queens or something. And like to see Boston and Austin and Chicago, like those are all cities that I feel like have that weird combination of like, we're small enough that we all know each other, but we're big enough that this will end up being support, like self-supporting, you know?
Yeah. So we actually, we have groups that apply. Like I had a group from, it's called Run Jump Dev, and they're from Kentucky, and it's just like four or five game studios that have a co-op space, and they all support each other, and they're in Kentucky, and they applied for the Mega Booth, and it was like one of those things where it's like, you know, I sort of look at the games, but then I'm also like, oh my god, that's so great that they're all trying to band together, because I don't know any developers in Kentucky, and like I wanted them to
really cool.
And I wanted them to come out and meet new people, and so we try and do that a lot too. We're like, we're not just doing game selections based on the merits of the game specifically. I mean, obviously it's a large portion of it, but it's also, you know, what are they doing for the indie community, and what can the indie community do for them also? Right. So situations where people, maybe they're isolated, or maybe they haven't had exposure to talking to other developers, like the opportunity just to even meet other people that are doing the same thing could be a huge difference, you know, and how they approach making games, or maybe how they're successful later. And, and so those types of things become very important as well.
I think it's like you can get these people who because it's kind of, because I'm from like the web atmosphere, and it's kind of the same there, but you can get these people who are just workhorses, right? You can see it in them. They're just like, they want to do this. This is all they've wanted to do forever. And they're going to work and build on it forever. And then when you put them around another group of like talented people who are doing the same thing, you just watch this like magical explosion happen where you're like, everything starts clicking for them, and you can see it.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, oh man, they're getting it. Like this is awesome.
Yeah.
So that's really cool that you look at that kind of, that's like one of the metrics sort of to see if you can, you know, matchmake, if that's a good term for it almost.
Yeah. I mean, it's really important too, because it's, I mean, there's obviously the indie scene and the gaming scene and any scene in general has its own drama, and you know, the tech scene, you're online, and so there's stuff on Twitter and blogs and all this other stuff, and it can feel sometimes very like, I don't know, like overwhelming or toxic or dramatic or something along those lines. And I really, one of the things that I like about the community that we're building with the Mega Booth is that we focus just solely on the positive aspects of the community building part. Like, it's very important that we have a good mix of people, a good mix of games that feels welcome, and that feels that people can come and they can go there and they can be supported to be successful, and they don't have to worry about being looked down on or discriminated against or any of these things, because I'm very careful about who we work with, who we partner with, and how we approach everything, where it's like, I have this saying that I always tell people, is that I don't think you have to be naive to be idealistic. Like, you can be idealistic and know exactly what's going on, and that's much harder because it's easy to become cynical, or it's easy to get frustrated, you know, when you constantly see things that aren't very positive. But, and like, I fully understand what I'm getting myself into. I still want to be idealistic about it. Like, I really
admire that positivity, because, I mean, that's one of the things you said, you were clicking around our site. And if you notice, we try to be a relatively positive site. And that's sort of our thing. Like, we love a lot of stuff. And so we don't really spew venom and talk too negatively about things that,
yeah,
you know, that
I think there's a fine line between being objectively critical and just being like, you know, hate machine essentially.
Which can become so draining for people. And I think it's nice to say, like, you know, we can show people too, hey, we can get a whole bunch of people together from a whole bunch of different backgrounds who are doing a ton of crazy things, and we can be a force for good in the games industry.
Yeah.
And like, one of the things that I'm starting to work on now is like, we're partnering with Extra Life, which is a fundraising charity for the Children's Miracle Network, where
say the name of it again.
You play games for 20 years.
The name of it again. Sorry, I broke up really quick.
It's called Extra Life.
Cool.
Oh, okay.
And so we made a team for the Mega Booth, which actually I have to work on some of that stuff this weekend. So what you do is you basically do marathon game playing. Like, you play games for 24 hours, and people can sign up for your team. And then each of the team members can pick the local children's network that their funding and stuff will go through. And like we try, I've worked with Able Gamers before, who helps people with disabilities have accessibility for games and things like that. And it's like, that's I want to try and involve and like sort of throw our weight around in as many of these, you know, sort of like good, like positive charity events. Yeah. And even talking with Extra Life, the woman that I was talking with, Carrie, who's local, she didn't know anything about the gaming scene. And she's like, and the whole games industry has been just so positive and so supportive. And she's like, I've just been totally blown away by how nice everybody is that's in the gaming community that participates with us in Extra Life. And I think sometimes, you know, gamers and the gaming community can get this like reputation of being in your parents' basement and like armchair warriors in the internet and stuff like that. And really, like, if you give people an opportunity to do something good, like, they'll step up for it. And I think the game community does it in spades a lot of times because there is such this weird stereotype for gamers for whatever reason.
No, I totally agree. A wild Hillary appears. Hi, Hillary.
Hey, how are you guys?
Hillary, you're an hour late.
I know.
Oh, man. I know. Hillary,
can I just say we're docking your pay. Oh no. Can I just say I was actually working on work, so it's not like I didn't have a good excuse.
It's okay. It's okay. Welcome. We're
she was like sleeping in and drinking mimosas.
I know. Right. I was out in my backyard in my hammock.
Yeah. She's like, oh yeah, I'll just join now.
Yeah. I'll just, you know, casually just join. No big deal.
So I want to, I teased you, not really teased you, it was more of a compliment, but Kelly, at PAX this year, I was saying that you have the absolute best title in probably the history of gaming because they refer to you as the Overlord. Mm-hmm. And do you like that title or is it something that you find to be strange? I mean, I think it's the best thing ever. I wish I could be an Overlord. I'm trying to figure out how to become an Overlord.
I think I might start adding like your friendly neighborhood overlord or something like that, like because the original name actually came like as a tongue-in-cheek thing, because the very first time that we ran the mega booth, like I said, it was like 16 or so companies and none of us had any idea what we were doing, and so everything was designed by committee. Like I would send out an email and be like, hey guys, like what do we think about this color for the logo, and then, you know, 15 very opinionated people are all giving opinions on the color of the logo. And it worked out well because it gave me a good barometer on how people react or think about certain things. And there were a lot of very smart people in it. But the second time that I ran it, everybody was sort of telling me you have to sort of just put your foot down about stuff. Like you can't please everybody all the time and you have to make a decision about things. And so I do a combination of running that now, especially now that it's much larger. If I sent out to ask 80 developers what they thought about something, I think I would never get anything done. So it was sort of this tongue-in-cheek. I think Ichiro might have even been the one to give me the title as a way to give me the confidence boost to, like, you know, really like put my foot down about decisions when I believed in them instead of taking a million opinions into consideration. So it's very tongue-in-cheek, and I think I like the title because I have a super dry sense of humor. Mm-hmm. So I figure people will get it eventually, and I find that funny. Yeah. So I think
the title is just awesome. I mean, yeah, it is the best title ever. It's a great title.
I did kind of expect like a 6 foot tall UFC fighter to walk out there, you know, just ready to kick ass.
The Overlord.
I actually smash all the booths in half when we're done.
I was like at the panel with you guys, and I'm like, so when's Kelly gonna show up? And you're like already sitting there. And I was like, no, there's gotta be like a 6 foot tall, like 200 pound, you know, UFC fighter ready to throw down with everybody.
Or at least a cape.
Yep. Or a cape.
Oh, I should get a cape.
Oh man,
I just get a cape. Great. I love putting it on paperwork, and like when I sign up for conferences and stuff now, the little name tag thing will always say like Kelly Wallach Overlord, because I'm like, I could do that because it's my company, I can put these ridiculous things on the paperwork.
Seriously,
and
right,
you
know. I think we need
maybe
to do that.
Put this in writing somewhere. What,
seriously,
we need to do that.
Yeah. And I actually when I founded the company too, so the company name is actually Indie Mega Corp Corp, so it's Indie Mega Corp Incorporated.
That even sounds like, it sounds like a super villain's company.
Mega Corp. Does, doesn't it?
Yeah. Like, you need to stop.
But now I'm sort of like, I'm on the phone with like insurance companies, you know, talking to some like 60-year-old guy who sells insurance to like who knows what, and I'm trying to explain to him what I do, and then giving him the company name, and my title is Overlord, and I'm just imagining this guy like rolling his eyes as hard as possible on the phone. Like, who am I talking about?
I'm the Overlord. That's awesome.
I personally find it amusing, so I think I'll keep it. But it is sort of like, I know, it's a bit out there for a title.
No, I love it. Let's talk, and I'm really curious about this one. But the process, and this is something we touched on briefly in the panel at Prime this year, but the process of actually getting chosen or selected, and you mentioned this earlier in our conversation today as well, but the process of actually getting chosen to be a part of the Indie Mega Booth, what is that like, and how difficult is that process for you guys to actually kind of root through all the... Like, would you use the term applicants or would you use submission? I don't know. I mean, the right term is.
If you don't mind saying numbers, like I know there's like 80 games or 80 developers this year at Prime, right? Am I getting the number right?
Yeah.
How many submissions did you get for Prime?
So we had like 170 or 180 or so submissions. Wow. Yeah. So, I mean, we did get about half of the people in, which is... And that ended up turning out. The first time we had the 16 companies and it was all just word of mouth. And for PAX East prior, actually, we did sort of slightly curate in the sense where I was still working at my job and it was too much. You know, people were getting interested at a faster rate than I could handle the influx. So I didn't want to overextend myself and then have the whole thing, you know, sort of fall apart. So we did curate sort of in the sense where like there were a couple games that got submitted that just sort of either weren't really games or, you know, I'm not sure where they came from. And then there was like maybe a half dozen or dozen or so people that were just like, I was just like, listen, sorry, we just don't have the space. We had a wait list though, because people tend to drop in and out because they are small companies. And, you know, if you're applying for something 6 months before it's going to happen, there's a lot that happens for a small team in 6 months worth of time. So we sort of technically curated for PAX East, but it was very like minimal. And then for PAX Prime, I came up with like a web form for a submission process and stuff because I was just all doing this through like email and Google Docs, you know, and then all of a sudden I'm getting hundreds of emails about stuff and it was getting like manually very intensive. So we set up a submission form and then I had a list of people that were interested. And then we always email out everybody from previously. And I was going to make a big press announcement and do like this whole big push to like get more people to submit. And then I went to go email and I was emailing like 200 people and I panicked. I just like emailed out the submission form and then didn't tell anybody else that we were like doing submissions. And I think we're going to sort of still keep it a bit like that, where we have a mailing list now on the website where people can sign up for it. And if people approach me about it, we send the information out. But I think I like that we're keeping it still a bit word of mouth and still more that people, like, once they're ready to show at a conference and they hear about us, they actively get in touch because they're interested in what we're doing or, you know, because it helps to keep the quality level high and it also helps with the community building stuff because you have people that are actively interested instead of people that are just sort of applying to everything that they can get their hands on.
Yeah. So it's still a bit organic then.
So
it's not.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not advertising to have people come submit their games to Indie Mega or anything.
Yeah, and I do a lot of developer outreach and stuff too. So like I'm, you know, going to be at IndieCade in a couple weeks or in a couple days, and I'll be talking with developers there. And I do a lot of like I go and try and give as many talks as I can, and that's what I was saying why I like the podcast format, because for me it's very one-on-one and sort of on the ground. That kind of stuff I think is important because it feels more personal. People can ask me questions because it's a bit like it's sort of abstract on what we're doing as an overall thing, you know. Yeah, and I like to personally sit down with people and let them know what we're doing and what we're looking for and stuff like that and answer questions. And so it's really like we're getting a good group of people that are submitting stuff and that end up in the space generally.
So cool. But when you're going through all of the submissions, what is the number one mistake that indies make when they're submitting stuff for Indie Mega Booth? Is there like one top tip that you should say, don't do this?
So our submissions is actually pretty like strange in the sense too, where we actually don't really require much of anything for the submission. Like we just require essentially, I think, a name and an email. We don't even require a demo, or screenshots or anything like that. That though is important. Like we had people that would just sometimes just submit a random description of what they may or may not do in the future. And that's pretty tough to go through. And, like,
I'm going to make the best game ever, ever, ever.
Yeah.
I'm making a first-person sort of like shooter based on Tetris. And you're like,
okay.
And it'll sell $1 billion.
Yeah, or you get really crazy, like I'm going to make a huge, like, immersive MMO, da da da, and this is our first game, and we're, you know, students, and I'm just like, oh, okay.
We've never set up a server before.
Send me a build
before.
If you get to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But we think we're going to be able to pull it off.
Yeah, so, yeah, so we went through, but then we also have a thing, too, where, like, you know, if you don't have a playable demo or you don't have a game at the moment, like, have you shown the capacity to make a game and release something at some point? You know, if you're an established company and you've made a couple things and this is just your new game, like, I don't necessarily need to look at, you know, a demo of the new thing to understand that, like, you are able to sit down and actually produce a game that could be shown at the conference. We also sort of benefit from the fact that, like, people are still paying for the space themselves, like the 10 by 10 booths and things like that. The mini booth we got sponsored, so this time around, and so that process is going to be a bit more of a, like, sort of a handpicked selection of people that we're, you know, helping to finance to be there, as a way to, like, help smaller groups that maybe they just don't financially, like, they can't financially afford to do full booth space, or maybe logistically they're just too small of a team or something like that, as a way to make sure that we're being as inclusive as we can be. There's sort of, like, we have two levels of acceptance, I guess, into the space, where you have, like, a main booth space or you have a shared booth space. And so maybe for smaller games or games that aren't quite there, like, the mini booth space makes more sense or something along those lines. So we went through, oh God, this took forever. It was weeks and, like, weeks of work. We had maybe about 8 or 9 people or so. I have different subsets of developers. So I had, you know, some younger new developers, some more experienced developers, some people that, you know, I just trust their judgment in the industry and things like that. And having everybody go through and comment, like I said, not only on the game, but also on what their involvement is in the community. Like, you know, maybe it's a student group, and so they would benefit really well from meeting other developers. Or maybe they've been making a couple interesting games, but they've never really had that big, like, push, but if they did, you know, they might be doing really well. Or maybe it's somebody that's really into, like, locally organizing a bunch of stuff. Like I was saying about the group from Kentucky, you know, like, we want to be able to support people that don't have support networks elsewhere. So we sort of go through and have all these comments and all this stuff about just everything that anybody submitted on there. Like, we have, like, a little section where you can put a statement about, you know, why you like the mega booth or something. And so if they're very community driven and very passionate about it, you know, then I might follow up more about their game if the game doesn't quite match what we're looking for, you know, follow up with them and see sort of where they are and what they're doing with stuff.
So,
and then I personally played all the games and stuff.
Did
too,
you really?
Like,
you played all of them this year?
Yeah.
That's insane.
Yeah, like,
I tried so hard to play so many, but there were, like, oh my gosh, I would have had to spend the whole weekend on there. That's awesome. You played all of them. I'm kind of jealous of that, actually.
I mean, it's really neat, but then actually a couple days into it, I was like, oh my God, I'm like, I can't believe that I'm feeling awful, like, sitting here and playing so many games. It's tough to play games with a sort of critical eye and to play stuff that's in process and all this other stuff. So it's, like, it's really cool. But then I was like, how did this become my work?
Yeah.
Like, why is this, like, work all of a sudden?
It's so hard. I don't know. This is going to sound like such a schmucky thing to say, too. But sometimes, you know, we get media badges and we go and we cover games and we talk to a lot of these people. And we'll play a game that's just not there yet. It's not that it's not good. It's just that it probably wasn't ready to really be shown quite yet.
Yeah.
And you're sitting there talking with the developers and like we're generally nice guys at the site and nice people in general. And so it's hard for us to be neutral in situations like that and be like, you know, like we'll come back later. It's really, really, it's hard.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. So sending out, you know, notices to people that we weren't able to provide them with space for this time was definitely the worst part of running the mega booth, I think, that I've ever done. It was really, like, I'm a very, like, I'm not very thick-skinned and I'm very, like, you know, hard on my sleeve type person. And I'm really, like, I, this kind of stuff, like, upsets me. Like, if I were to get a letter, you know, from somebody that I wasn't accepted for a space for something, like, I would feel terrible, you know, that would hurt my feelings. So, like, then I'm sending out these. And a lot of the times it's not like the games weren't good or they weren't playable. I mean, we had that in some sense, but, like, we had a lot of really great things to be going through and to be choosing from. And so even when we couldn't offer people space, I individually sent out emails to each person with, like, options on auxiliary space that I worked with Penny Arcade to set aside for developers up on, like, this floor. And then people that weren't going to need their space because they're in the mega booth. And then alternative options, like the Seattle IGDA had an expo that was, like, across the street, that was, like, $20 for a table.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and so, and then I gave people the opportunity that, hey, if you have any questions, like if you want to know more feedback or anything, like I had tons of follow-up calls with people. We had the wait list. And so there are people even that I worked with for months leading up to PAX that like we would have a space open, and, you know, they were really proactive on working with me and showing me how things were going with the game. And then it's like, when we have a space open up, then like, you know, that opportunity is open for them. So we really, it was a lot of work, but I think I'm going to keep doing that, because I don't like the idea of having it just be this random decision
I think,
you know, and it's not a conversation.
I think that also gives you kind of the heads up of what you're dealing with as far as developers go. Because I think that if you said, no, sorry, we don't have the space, there are two kinds of reactions, right? There's going to be, or maybe three, but the third one would be horrible. But there's two kinds of reactions. One is like, you know, where you say, but if you have any questions, or there's this, this, or this that we can maybe help you with, and they react to it going like, oh, great, and they're in touch with you and definitely like moving on it, then it lets you kind of know, like, from your perspective, oh, this is a developer who you probably want to work with again, or that you want to keep your eye on at the very least. And if they just kind of like shut up and go into a hole and never talk to you again, then it's like, okay, well, how are we going to deal with this? You know?
Yeah.
I think that's a good indicator, or maybe a good takeaway for a developer to be like, oh, if I'm proactive, then it looks better on my part at the end of the day too, you know?
Well, it's also, I mean, it also benefits them in the sense that if you can understand what happened and you use it as a learning experience and you use that to grow as a developer and to make the game better or to make the company better or something like that, like that's an opportunity for you to learn and to grow. And if you aren't open to having that opportunity, you know, like you are going to have, things are not always going to go exactly the way that you want to. And like, you are going to have to deal with, you know, rejections and difficult situations. And how do you deal with that? You know, do you shut down? Do you lash out? Do you be positive with it? And like I had mentioned, we try to keep everything as positive as possible. So, you know, having a negative reaction to me being as helpful as I can possibly be in the situation is sort of like, oh, okay, you know, maybe they're not quite there yet, or maybe this is like, there's more going on than you know, what we can help with or what we can do or something like that. So really, we only had two or three people, I think, total that really were like just flat out unhappy, and I just wasn't able to help in some way.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just gonna say, a lot of the people that ended up with space on the sixth floor, like I went up there and I talked with them and met with them, and they were like really happy that they had the opportunity to show at the conference, and like we're still able to do something, you know, good for them, even if I wasn't specifically organizing their space in the mega booth.
So is there like, do you even, so the first year you had Mark of the Ninja, right? At one point, I think, in the indie booth.
Clay's been in a bunch of times. Yeah.
Is there a point where you, is there like a line in your head, or is there a point that you think maybe a company or a game has outgrown the indie mega booth, or you know, like it's kind of a weird way. We talk about music a lot on the podcast. Scott and I were in bands, and defining what is indie and what wasn't was like really hot in the early 2000s. Yeah. Is like, this band's not indie or that band is indie. Is there a point where you feel like somebody maybe outgrows, even in a positive way, outgrows the mega booth? And how do you kind of decide that? And, you know, like, is Clay a good example of one who had their own booth this year, I think, outside of indie mega booth? So,
I think what ends up happening normally is that the developer recognizes that they're in that situation. So like Cappy wasn't in a space with us, and they were partnering with Double Fine, and they had a big location, you know, on their own. And that was more, and even from Ethan's perspective, like from us, it's good to have a big company like that because it helps to draw in traffic. It helps to make it, you know, seem legitimate to other developers and stuff like that. But then it's also the perspective, you know, Nathan is like, I don't want to take the opportunity away from somebody else because I don't really need the support, or I don't need the opportunity in the same way that somebody else would need it. Clay is still in the space. So Clay is sort of interesting because they come out with new games pretty much like all the time, and they help to make the mega booth the mega booth, you know, like they help behind the scenes with stuff, and Jamie like helps out with advice. And so we have some companies like that too, where it's like they could outgrow it, I guess, if they really wanted to, but they like the involvement in the community. That's and awesome. For a lot of the developers, for a lot of the developers to meet and talk with them is a good opportunity, and you know, to see what they're doing and all that. And then for them to be able to give us the sort of behind the scenes support is important as well. So like we've had Ska Studios has been in every single time that we've run the mega booth, Deja Bon as well. So it's like we sort of have these people, and you know, Vlambeer and Young Horses and stuff, obviously. It's like we have these people that are involved in creating what the community is, and as long as they want to they want to keep participating, like they're always going to be welcome because they are making the community what it is, you know, awesome. by helping out with the mega booth. So I'm actually getting in a situation too where we have to be careful that we're not showing like the same games over and over and stuff like that. But most people, by the time that they launch something, they want to take a break or you know, they don't want to come back and show with us until they have another game anyway. So we really haven't, we've been fortunate that we haven't really run into that too much. But you know, if things get sort of too out of hand, maybe we'll do something where some companies can show at Prime, some can show at East, and we're going to be expanding into Gamescom. So then like some can show at Gamescom and maybe we just cycle through you know, certain games or certain companies or something over the course of like a year of conferences.
This might be totally hypothetical and pointless at the end of the day, but do you think, let's just throw it out there and see what happens. But you know, part of the problem, and again, I'll relate it to kind of music. Like one of the things that we saw happening was like Sony would buy up a little indie label and then not really put their name on it, but kind of have their name on it, you know what I mean? Like, so it'd be like, I'm trying to think of a good example, but you know, like Matador is owned by Red, I think, which is owned by Sony. It's like some like crazy chain that's gone up, and Matador is obviously a gigantic example. But do you ever fear that, you know, Microsoft's going to be like, here's our indie studio, we want to be an indie mega booth for like Cred or something like that? Or do you think that'll kind of work itself out just by community?
So it works itself out a lot by community. We have had publishers and stuff come and want a booth by themselves. And so the way that we handle that is that individual company has to submit their game, and they have to submit it on the merits of their game and not the publisher being involved in it. And then, however, you know, that's addressed for, you know, who's paying for the space as far as the publisher goes, then, you know, that's up to them. But it's, I really like when I'm saying that we go through the submissions, like we really vet everything. Like I look up people's Twitter, Facebook, I look them up online. I talk to people to see what they know about them and who they know. If I'm confused about like where their funding is coming from, or, you know, it seems like something that's not really in the indie spirit, I'll email them and just ask them a question. And a lot of times if it's actually a big company like that, that's sort of trying to like pull the wool over eyes, they just don't respond.
Right.
Cause they're like, oh crap,
we've been found,
you know, like we got caught on this. But we also, like, we don't really address what is considered indie in the submission form. We just have a checkbox that says, do you in good faith consider yourself an indie developer? And that's it. It's sort of one of those, like, you know it when you see it type of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, maybe in the future, indie obviously is not going to mean what it means now, but for now and for the space and for how things are, it's like, we're sort of trying to capture a snapshot of what the indie scene is currently, you know, and what's going on and what people are working on and all the different sort of facets of that. And I'm not too worried about some like huge company coming in like tricking us, because a lot of those companies I'm working with at this point. So it's like they would have to be pretty old to try and like, send something over at this point, because like I know a lot of what's going on behind the scenes, even if, you know, they're not totally aware of it.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
So I have kind of an off the wall question. So
I like
you
these.
Could,
I like these.
if you could make a game that was totally yours, what game would you make?
Oh geez.
told you so off the wall.
I know. So my sister and I were going to try and make it. Like I originally got in the games industry because I wanted to make a video game. Now I've changed my mind. I don't think I actually want to make a video game. It seems like a lot of work. I want to help other people make their games. But our original game idea was going to be like this 2D, 3D thing where you were like a piece of graffiti art and you were like interacting with other street art. There's a couple like, not like a, not Bansky or sort of in that vein of stuff where people do these weird things where it sort of looks 3D, but it's not quite 3D. And they do it through like graffiti on a wall and on a sidewalk and stuff like that. And so we're going to sort of like play with, So we wanted to sort of play with those ideas and have where like, you know, you, I don't know, or maybe like erasing things or drawing things, you know, sort of like scribble knots-ish and stuff like that. And so that was our original idea. And then we tried to make it and it was like a horrible disaster. It never went anywhere. So that would be my game. Graffiti art world game.
Hillary, if you asked me that question, I would have failed miserably because I would have no answer. Like if I had to make a game, it would just be like I would have no clue.
So no, I'm sure you'd come up with something. Maybe like butts.
Butts.
Butts the game.
Butts the game.
So I do want to address the growth. Speaking of butts, let's talk about growth. The growth of the
say about fat ass.
Jeez.
Oh, whoa.
I just broke the, just broke the podcast.
Yeah, no, nice going there.
In all honesty, the Megabooth's been growing. So I'm looking at quotes here, and it says, you know, the first year there was 16 developers, 20 games, and then 2012 at Prime there was 30 developers and 30 games, and then the East was 50 developers and 62 games, and Prime was like over 80 and 100, right, or something around that. So, what is the end goal for this? Is it to keep expanding, or are you going to finally cap it and be like, I mean, because you deal with all of this hands on. So, at what point do you explode? And at what point can you not handle like the growth of what this is becoming? Because you can see, I mean, that's a lot of growth for just a few years. So,
yeah, I think. So the 80 some developers that we had this time, one of the ways that we helped to sort of inflate our numbers without it becoming too crazy was we have like 50-ish main booth spaces, and then we had 30 companies in the mini booth. And the companies in the mini booth were showing maybe Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, Monday. Some were showing all 4 days, and some were only showing one day each.
Okay.
So we were able to give people an opportunity with sort of, well, in the future, that will be less logistically challenging for me now that I know what I'm doing with it. But it helps to get more people in there without it, you know, sort of ballooning the physical size of the space. I think probably around where we were for Prime is about as large as I think we can get before people start to get that like total overload on coming in and seeing just like the overwhelming choice options, you know, where people like you have too many options and you just panic and like freeze up because you don't know what to do. So I think we might physically or, you know, at least company number wise, stay somewhere in there. Whether the physical space expands or not is depending on which conference we're at. But I also want to expand into Gamescom, which we're working with the organizers to do for this upcoming year. And then I probably wouldn't go into another conference until another year after that, just because I am aware that, you know, growing too fast, too quickly can really be sort of a disaster.
Yeah.
We Gamescom, do have
that's exciting though, the fact that you're going to be bringing everything overseas, and that's going to be incredible. Yeah, it's going to be insane.
Yeah, so, I was out there this past summer right before PAX Prime, and it was crazy.
Oh, did you? Yeah, I've never been. It's one of the shows I've been really eager to get to, but obviously it's kind of far away.
So Kelly, I can absolutely kind of understand what it's like. I mean, I'm not an overlord yet, but I do some work in events. So I know how much of a labor of love it is, and you have to really love it to pull it off successfully, which you absolutely have. But what do you get out of it? Like what is the thing that you think is, I don't know, your personal goal for the Indie Mega Boost?
I mean, I think besides the expanding into the other conferences and stuff, really a lot of it has to do with the community building and to be doing something positive to help people become successful in it. And I really, really love the team of people that we have working with us. I love the developers that we work with. And it's really rewarding to see a company go through the whole process with us. Like we have a mailing list where people are, you know, asking questions and going back and forth for months and months. And, you know, and I have people emailing me on the side, like when they're panicked about something, and then to see it all come together and see them get some press or to talk to a publisher or, you know, even just to meet other developers or even just to see fans playing their game. It's just personally really rewarding for me. And I always manage stuff at other companies as well. And I realize that even though it sounds sort of boring, I really like facilitating other people to find what they're good at and to be successful at what they're good at.
That's
and
awesome.
So, yeah. So building that portion of the Mega Booth, I think, is what I really want to be focusing on. And I was actually talking with somebody about this recently when I was in the sciences. When you learn about the way the world works and the way it functions on this sort of very like intense, basic level, like it really puts a lot of things in perspective. And like your place in life at that point as a scientist is to help to explain what's happening in the world around you and to like give that knowledge and that information to other people. And it was sort of like comforting in a way because then like that's my place and that's what I do. And now it's like I'm helping other people to find their place in what they want to do in their life. And it's like I feel like that could be really great to give to somebody. And it's a really unique opportunity to be in a position to help somebody find that for themselves. So it's sort of like, I don't know. I mean, it's altruistic, but then there's sort of the theory that like even when you're doing something altruistic, you're doing it because it makes you feel good.
Yeah.
So it's basically like I get to feel good about helping other people. And no, that's sort of like great, that's, great that's the benefit I'm getting out of it.
That's awesome. Yeah.
It's a lot better than saying I'm doing it for all the money and riches, and I just want to be an overlord and control everything. It's a much better answer than the answer I probably would have had.
I just like rolling around in money.
Yeah, I would have just shouted overlord, and that would have been my entire answer. But overlord.
We have to ask one more, like, real brief one before we go, because I think Scott will kill us if we don't mention this game to you. But he has been playing the Swapper, like, constantly, endlessly playing it and talking about it on every podcast that he can.
Loves the Swapper.
Yeah.
And he has, like, two questions that really are, like, barely questions, but they're kind of like, what's it like? What was it like working with them? Because apparently they call you out in the credits, and they do you have any thoughts on a game like that that kind of starts out sort of nowhere and then explodes and ends up in the PAX 10 and all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, actually, I mean, Ollie's really great. I helped them out a bunch when they were launching the game and stuff like that, and giving them advice on things. And yeah, I mean, it's interesting to see it from that perspective where they worked on it for so long. Like, Ollie is very quiet. He's very introverted, and he's super particular about every detail of everything. And it's just, I cannot believe that, you know, young students essentially made that game, because it's just, it's incredible and it's beautiful. And the inspiration for how they did with the clay models and stuff is that his mom is actually an artist, and she works with like clay and physical things, and he didn't know how to do 3D modeling, so he's like, I'll just make it out of clay because like that's what I know how to do. And just having, you know, somebody say something that sounds so simple, you know, like, oh, of course, I'll just make this stuff out of clay. And really being careful about like how they did the puzzles, and just every inch of every detail of everything in that game was really thought over very much by Ollie and by Tom and you know, Otto and all those people that are involved in the team. And sort of seeing them take that and then give that to the rest of the world is sort of like scary and exciting at the same time for them, because you've been working on it for so long and it's so personal. And then what if you put it out there and people hate it? You know, like what becomes of your life if that's the situation that you're in? And they're very young, and you know, this is the first time that they had launched something.
Yeah.
So seeing them go through that entire process, and then when they launched the game and getting like, I think the first review that they got was a 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
I think it was on Destructoid, or was it Destructoid? Was it the first review that came out? And like, you could just like, I could almost like physically like feel the weight off Ollie's shoulders from that.
That's awesome.
I think he was like, yeah, it's so scary, you know, to put something like that out there and then to have such great reception and people really love it. And it was really, really great to see that from them. And you know, working with them in the mega booth and then working with them on the launch stuff and everything is just really great.
That's cool.
That's awesome. That's cool. Very, very cool.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad that he really likes it. He should have him email me. I'll send I don't know if he's ever talked to Ollie. I can pass over an intro or something.
He would probably love that. Yeah he's been talking about it constantly, so it's sort of his thing right now.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I'm sure Ollie would love that.
Awesome. Yeah. Well, Kelly, thank you so much for coming on. Do you have any announcements about where that Megabooth is going to be next, or perhaps you know, where people can find you on the internet or anything like that?
Yeah, so the website is one of the things that I really want to start increasing the traffic in between conferences. And we started having original content that's written by Christopher Floyd, who's actually the first person who ever interviewed me.
Oh, wow.
So
that's cool.
Yeah. So he's been writing original content on there. We're going to hopefully have forums and stuff. We have the mailing list that I mentioned that we're going to start making announcements to fans and to developers if they have questions about the Mega Booth. I'm super easy to personally get in touch with. Like, I'm just Kelly Wallach, or Kelly at Indie Mega Booth at basically everything. So I'm like Kelly Wallach on Twitter. I'm Kelly Wallach at Gmail. Like, I'm easy to find. So, and I answer all my emails, even if it takes me a while. So if somebody drops me a line, like, I always respond to it.
You got back to me. And I think I was email 104 from after.
Yeah. I'm staring at my inbox now. It's at 111. So
oh,
it's
my
nice,
gosh.
Yeah. 1111. Thankfully, there's not another one at the end of that. But yeah, check out the website. The Twitter account is just at Indie Mega Booth. We have Facebook also. I'm sure it's just like Facebook at Indie Mega Booth. And we'll be at PAX East. I'll be at IndieCade. I'll be at GDC. And we'll be at Gamescom also. Awesome. We're all over the place. We're all up in your indie business.
That is great.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. It was so much fun.
Yeah.
I learned.
Thank
I
you
learned
guys
many
for
things.
Having me on.
Of course. Awesome. You're welcome. We're back.
The long and sordid story of the Mega Booth.
Yeah. Right. No. I thought it was really actually super interesting. So I think people will really really like it.
And it all started with a lab explosion.
A lab explosion. Back.
Yay, that was a good talk.
Yay.
That was definitely a good talk. It was so much fun.
Yes. She's pretty awesome. And I do agree that like it's I love hearing about people who start things, you know, and kind of almost in like a punk rock fashion, like, oh, this system doesn't work. I'm just gonna do it my way. And then it just like happens, you know. So that is
absolutely
pretty awesome.
Yeah, I just like all the advice she was giving about you know, people taking rejection well. Mm-hmm. And I think she didn't mention this, but I mean, the industry is so small that it's really important that even when doors are closed, that you realize that they're not always closed.
Yeah.
You know? So I think that was really good advice. And I really appreciated her, you know, talking about that.
Yeah.
So she's really cool. I like her a lot.
Yeah. That's awesome. We'll try to have her back sometime, but it's
absolutely.
Cool.
Yeah. Definitely closer to East next year. We'll have to have her on to let her tell us how
time.
Yeah. That's
right.
Crazy for her probably.
It's kind of a big deal that she does.
So Hillary, what are you up to right now? This very
moment. So as we're recording,
we should talk about the conversation we were just having about the shower.
No, we should not talk about that. That is not okay. The only thing that I'll say about that is I think it's hilarious that Matt asked for permission to take a shower.
He did.
But other than that, no, let's see, as we're recording right now, BioWare's at Edmonton Expo. So I'm helping to manage that remotely, and I help put it together. So I'm really excited about some of the things that BioWare is doing there. Holly and Jessica will be in costume at the booth, and Mark Meir is stopping by at about 4 p.m. So it's going to be a really good time. And I think he's going to be wearing his Vorcha costume, which is going to be
so cool.
So if you hear this and you live in Edmonton and you have a time machine...
Exactly. I know. I'm sorry. I'm dropping it like it's
days.
Like promo, but it's not... I'm just super excited about it because,
awesome.
You know, getting to work with Mark is amazing. He's a great guy. And Holly and Jessica, of course, are amazing. I've been working on that. And then I'm putting together the plans for Geek Girl Con, which I'm super excited about.
We'll
I'm on three panels.
On
I know. We have two new correspondents.
Well, sort of one. The other one didn't get a press pass, but
yeah.
One and a half.
Well, whatever.
One and a half new correspondents.
Yeah.
I know. I'm super excited about that.
If you see two angry half Asian girls walking around looking like they hate their husbands, that's probably my wife and Ash's wife. If one of them has a nerd appropriate badge, so look out for them.
Yep.
Yes, I will buy them cupcakes.
Oh, they would love cupcakes.
They would love that.
Yes. Yeah, I'm really excited to get to hang out with them. Help put together some of the nerd appropriate presents for
GeekCon. Yeah, that's exciting.
Yeah. So Mylan and I are going to be on three panels, and I'm helping put together the BioWare stuff. So it's going to be a big little show.
Do you have not to put you on the spot, do you know the titles of the three panels you guys are on?
There is one about world building, and that's with Patrick Weeks and Karen Weeks.
Good
so
times.
That's going to be super awesome. We're doing a freelance panel with... Bonnie Burton and Holly Conrad, moderated by Jessica Marison.
Awesome.
And there's another one too. It's
not
gonna
too
be...
dangerous to go alone is coming back.
Yes. That is a really,
that
really
was a good panel.
One.
It was.
Yeah. So Kenna, who's the moderator on that one, she's fantastic. And she's going to be moderating a group of us who talked at PAX Prime.
She runs Geek Portland, right? Is that her?
Yes.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. So it's all about, you know, tips and tricks on how to start your career in freelancing or, you know, getting out there and doing what you love and having the courage to just, you know, look at your life and say, this is what I want to do and go for it. So, I'm really excited about that one, actually. And I'm glad that we're doing a repeat of that for Geek Girls at Geek Girl Con.
Awesome.
Very cool. Yeah.
So what have you been up to, Ash?
Oh, boy. Take that, Matt.
I hate this.
I say this every fucking week now, but I had a really busy week. But I did manage to play some more GTA 5. I will just tell a brief GTA 5 story that kind of explains how ridiculous this game is. One of the things that's really unique about the game is right now there are three main protagonists, and you can switch between them at almost any time during the game. But they actually go about their lives when you're not playing as them. So they won't stay where you left them. They'll actually go off and like drive around town and do different stuff and get into fights. And, you know, when you switch back into their bodies, you could be midway through some, you know, bizarre event that's occurring. So one time you'll switch to the character Trevor and he'll be in a high speed chase with like 25 cops behind him. And then you'll be kind of stuck playing that content. Or one time you'll be like out in the middle of the desert, you know, sitting there talking to some stranger that you met, you know, when you actually weren't even playing. But this morning when I played, I switched over to the character Trevor, and he was half naked on the top of the highest mountain in the game, wearing a dress, vomiting.
Are you serious?
He was wearing a dress, vomiting. Yeah. And I was like, well, what the fuck? And there were no cars around, no planes around. So I had to walk back from like the middle of nowhere wearing like a strange dress that I found. And like, you know, you kind of wander down this hill, like stumbling down this mountain, like, and finally find the highway and steal a car. But it's such a, the game has grown on me a lot in terms of the narrative. Like as you get a little bit deeper into the story, it's still a very dark story, but the relationship between the characters is actually very well written. There's a lot of depth to the characters that I didn't necessarily see in the beginning because of all the violence and because of, you know, how dark in tone the game was. But it's great. And GTA Online comes out for free on October 1st, I believe. And GTA Online is going to be kind of a persistent world that you can play with your friends. So you're actually going to kind of host your own mini server based in the GTA world. So that's pretty exciting, and I'm excited about that.
You can cause mayhem together.
Yeah, group mayhem. Matt, what about yourself?
Man, I had a week, I guess. I, you know, worked some stuff. So the one thing I did start doing is, and this will either make people like me more or hate me for realizing that I had never done it previously, but I started my first ever Dragon Age campaign this week.
Yeah.
So after listening to all this stuff, there's only so many times I can listen to Dragon Age stuff before I'm like, finally, like, okay, I should probably play this game at some point in my life. And I actually bought it a while ago. It was in one of the like fire sales on Xbox. I bought Dragon Age Origins. It's just been sitting like kind of not installed on my computer, and on my Xbox. And I was finally like, really the real driving force to it was that Dragon Age. I told Ash this: Dragon Age Inquisition looks so damn good that I feel like now I like want to play the other two before it comes out, which I have plenty of time. But play the other two before it comes out so that I can actually play that game and enjoy it in real time with you guys. So.
Yay!
So I started a campaign with a female dwarf rogue.
So crazy.
That's awesome.
Castless. It was the storyline that I went with, which is pretty damn awesome. You know, you forget when you don't play BioWare games for a little while, because I haven't played anything since my crazy playthrough of Mass Effect 3, which if anyone remembers back then, I don't even know what podcast that would have been, probably in the 50s or 60s maybe, or 70s.
Yeah.
There was so much stuff going on about Mass Effect 3. I hadn't played it. This was like, the game came out on Tuesday, and on Saturday I still hadn't played it yet. And everybody was leaking, you know, spoilers about every different part of the game, including the ending. And I was like, Jesus. So I actually played Mass Effect 3 in a day and a half, or in 2 days. I played it over a weekend and beat the entire thing. And it was insane. It tired me out so fast. Like, it was crazy. Yeah.
It's very emotional, too.
I kind of put BioWare stuff down and didn't really play any heavy games like that for a while, but picking this game back up, the story is so damn good. It is weird not having a main character that's voiced. I've gotten very used to that.
I'm so glad they changed that.
but it's great, and I can see why everybody, you know, hoots and hollers about oh Jesus. I do this. Why do I have to forget some name every podcast?
Alistair?
Alistair.
Yeah. Oh, Alistair. Yeah.
He's hilarious. I like him. He's cool. And I mean, I'm not at any romancing point in my game, but he's a cool guy.
Yeah. I would say that you should definitely test that out.
Female dwarf.
Mm-hmm. It's time to play Dragon Age Spoilers!
I do have to ask you quickly, not to talk about Dragon Age for too long, but you got to the part, the Battle of Ostagar, right? With the king and everything and the big betrayal. Did you get to that?
No.
Spoilers!
Okay. Okay, so
a better question is, have you met Duncan yet?
No, I don't think I'm not very far in. I'm only like five, 6 hours in, maybe. I think.
Okay,
you should have definitely met him yet. I mean, already.
Then did I meet him? Who is he?
Did you go to a camp? Like, did something happen to you, and then you were transported does something happen to you, and like you have to go to this place where there's a war? And you have to fight the bad things.
So, I mean, I left off on, I was in the tower fighting the giant golem-y thing.
There you go. Okay.
And and I died 7 times fighting that damn thing.
Okay, so you're at Ostagar right now.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. Do you have a dog?
I don't think I've been betrayed yet, though, honestly. So I think that Ash ruined that part for me.
Sorry.
Thanks, buddy. No, it's fine. I don't care.
Here's a huge question. Did you help save the sick dog?
Yes, I did.
Good.
I did.
The dog's important.
Because I like dogs.
He's actually a little boy named Tim.
No.
I made that up.
But also, what did you name your... Oh, wait, never mind.
You want to know?
Yeah, what did you name him?
Why'd you say never mind? Oh, name the dog? Know. Is that what you're going to say? Yeah. I don't have a dog yet, so...
Okay.
Just ruin the whole game for me, guys. Why don't you tell me the whole ending right now? Just go ahead and run me through the entire story because you're so excited about this. Please.
There's a dragon at the end.
Oh, God.
So Alistair gets naked.
Okay. Oh, boy.
Whatever.
Anyway.
Anyways, it seems fun, and I'll let you guys ruin a little bit more of the story every time we have a podcast from here on out.
Yay. I'll but you know like, it's not? But you know it's not going to ruin the podcast? Oh,
sports?
Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry, did I step over your thing?
You did.
You kind of stepped over mine, and then I kind of stepped over yours. It was like weird. It was like
this whole thing is blowing up, Matt.
It was like our legs were tied together, and we were trying to have a race. You know, it's not going to work.
Like a potato sack race.
Like a potato sack. Isn't it a different kind of race though? What's it called? The three-legged race.
This is awesome. I feel bad for anybody listening.
You've never heard
this.
Of a three-legged race? This is a real thing.
It is.
Ash knows all about the three-legged race.
Oh, God, you're making penis jokes. That's not what I was saying.
Let's just talk about dicks.
Let's talk about sports, guys.
Wow.
Hillary, are you going to sing the football intro we can't sing again? Okay. So, in the old NAF, the Nerd Appropriate Fantasy Football League is going on again. And as usually happens, when you talk shit in fantasy football, you get 100% destroyed the next week. And after talking shit in fantasy football, my team... So I have 3 fantasy football leagues that I run. I have one, the Nerd Appropriate one. I have one that like my family and some friends are in. And then there's another one that one of Scott's friends runs and I just kind of play in. If you took all of those teams that I have and combined all of their scores, I still could not have beaten any of my opponents. I lost so bad. I had multiple teams that had like 30 points. And to put that into perspective, usually you score over 100. So it was bad week for me. A very, very, very bad week, as you'll hear. But in the Nerd Appropriate League, there was, again, some more movement. Ryan, Serious Business, Ryan Clark, is holding, maintaining his lead. He's the only one who's lossless at the moment. He's 3-0. He's in first place. In second place, Sean Baptiste steps up 2 positions with the PK and Sandys. And tied for, well, technically because their points are a little, why is she in third? That doesn't make any sense. Anyways, in third place is Karen Weeks, Beholder the Glory, sitting in the top 3 still after The entire draft, I wish I had a transcript. The entire draft, she was talking about how, oh, I don't know if I don't really know. I'm just kind of random picking, blah, blah. I'm going to do horribly. And she's been top three all season so far. So we will see what happens. But actually, after making fun of him, Scott was the one who beat me last week in the Nerd Appropriate League.
Nice. Nice.
So he actually moved up above me, and he's in fifth at the moment. But yeah, it was a bad week for me, good week for everybody else. So we've got some more movement. We'll keep talking about it every week. And then let's get to the next part of this. I forget what we called it because it had a really long title, but it was something like the Nerd Appropriate Pick'em League Fantasy Football Pick'em Times with everybody, Ash and Hillary time.
Yes, that sounds about right.
Mm-hmm. Where Hillary wins.
Got to come up with a real title at some point, I guess. Right now it's the Napple. Naple.
Whoa.
It's N-A-P-E-L. Naple. Napple.
Juicy Naples.
Juicy Naples. All right. God, just erase 30 minutes of my life. The first game, Texans versus the Ravens. Ash went with the Texans. Hillary went with the Ravens because Hillary likes Ravens and Ash is terrified of death.
Yeah.
And Edgar Allan Poe, yo. Mm-hmm.
And Edgar Allan Poe, yo.
Oh, yo.
You were cracking me up last week with the... What'd you say? In the hizzy or something? I don't remember. It was
I don't know.
Anyways, the winner, the real winner of this game, for all those that somehow can hear things, real winner of this game was the Ravens over the Texans. Hillary.
This is an upset.
Hillary coming out on top
on
that one.
How do you like them apples, Ash?
I feel like this is false information.
It feels like maybe I just said some things incorrectly and I led Ash to believe he was winning and then we re-recorded the whole thing. But that's not what happened. This is the first time you guys are hearing this.
Yes.
I was going to say, I usually don't have such bad luck.
I know. So Hillary's up one game. Next game, Rams versus the Cowboys. The real winner of the Rams versus the Cowboys is the Cowboys. Ash gets the win for picking the cheerleaders. White hats, white boots, something like that. Hillary trying to stay with California. No win for you. I'm sorry. And the last game, Chargers versus the Titans. The winner was... Are you ready, even though you both picked the same thing?
I'm this is intense.
The Titans beat the Chargers.
Yay!
Yeah. So we're tied again.
So you're still tied this week, even though you
have
different picks.
How is that even possible?
Because you split the win loss.
Yeah. Yeah. So we're totally tied.
You are
again.
Totally tied up right now.
I just want to win.
You guys are
I just want to win. Oh. That's going to be on your tombstone.
I know.
You guys are 4-2 right now each, which actually is a pretty damn good record. So this week, you know, it kind of sucks. We can never pick the Thursday night game, and it was a game I was thinking about picking just to give Hillary the hometown advantage, but it was the Niners versus the Rams.
Mm.
And the Niners absolutely slaughtered the Rams. So,
of course they did, because they're the Niners.
They are. All right. Game number one.
Uh-oh.
After a bunch of controversy that I know you guys know about, I'm going to ask you to talk about it for real quick. We have the Cardinals versus the Buccaneers. Now, what do you think about all this quarterback controversy, guys?
Well, I really feel as though the Cardinals quarterback should not have taken illegal substances to perhaps enhance his game playing abilities.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, he needs to stop taking
so drugs. I'm going to actually agree with you on that, Ash, because you know, it's really not possible for a human to fly.
No.
And
it's
really weird that he was taking his team name so literally.
it's
he was
weird.
Actually trying to be a cardinal, right?
He glued a bunch of red feathers to himself.
Oh.
It's just not natural.
It's not. It is not natural. So who are you guys picking this week? We've got the Cardinals versus the Buccaneers.
I honestly thought the Cardinals were a baseball team.
They are a baseball team. You're not wrong. But
can they fucking do that?
So St. Louis Cardinals is
the
baseball
Giants?
Team. St. Louis Cardinals are the baseball team. The Arizona Cardinals are the football team.
Oh.
The and Giants the are also team? The same thing, Hillary. Very good. What?
Mm-hmm.
What's the other team? The Cardinals versus the
Buccaneers.
Oh, okay. I'm going to go with the Buccaneers because I am from Florida.
There you go.
There you go.
I'm going to go with the Cardinals because my mom's mom, my grandma, loved Cardinals.
Thank you for clarifying.
Thanks for clarifying. I was like, mom's mom? How does that even happen?
Nosebleed. What?
My mom's mom loved the Cardinals. Or just she loved Cardinals in general, not the Cardinals. But yeah, so there's like things that have little red birds on them. So I'm going to pick the Cardinals.
Nice. Right. That's my grandmother liked, my mom's mom really liked Cardinals as well, actually. Now, do you call your grandma, or do you call her something weird like Meemaw or Poopaw or something?
No, I called my mom's mom Mimi.
Okay.
And I called my grandma my grandma. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Huh. So it's Mimi and grandma.
How about you, Ash?
Yeah, that's,
you call
that's a
grandmas?
Lot of information.
I called her grandma.
All right. Game two.
That was very touching, guys. It's very tender.
Yeah.
Game two. This week, we have a classic showdown. The Bengals versus the Browns. Now, as we know, one of these teams is in a rebuilding year. So what do you guys think? What do you think here?
Hillary, do you want to first?
Yeah, I'll jump in. Yeah, yeah. I like Bengal Tigers, okay. So I'm going to pick that.
All right.
Okay. I'm going to pick the Browns for a couple of reasons. Number one, Bengals have the most heinous costume that they wear.
Uniform, you mean?
Uniform, sorry.
when they're out there cosplaying?
Yeah, the football cosplay.
Ash is actually letting something out right now. What happened last Sunday, Ash?
What do you mean? I forget.
What did you do?
I honestly don't remember at this point. I watched football at Matt's house. I did. And I ate chicken wings and I actually enjoyed it. It was fun.
He didn't know what football.
I did. I didn't have
did you ask questions?
This was, I did ask constant but questions.
Yeah, well, what's a first down?
No, I knew that. I played Mutant League football, so I know the rules.
Yeah. 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 I mean, you knew those rules, but you were asking questions about the teams and who was who and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Like questions like, does the kicker ever get killed? Things like that.
Yeah.
I think that this is really unfair because I do not have the advantage of going and having teacher time.
Hey,
with...
move to Florida. You can come watch football with me every weekend if you want.
Okay. So also the reason I'm picking the Browns, first of all, the Bengals, bad costumes. Second of all, the Browns. We all have a bit of the Browns now and again.
Right. And
sometimes, you know,
but
sometimes you think you're going to fart, not a fart. So you get the Browns.
I mean, I can't argue with you there. I think it's a great point.
I knew you were going to do that. I was like, it has to always come back to butts. Yep.
So our final game, this nerd appropriate pick 'em. Is a showdown, Monday night showdown, between the Dolphins and the Saints. Both surprising 3-0 teams right now. What do you guys think?
Well, the Saints go marching in.
They do. So. That's true. The Saints do go marching in. What do the Dolphins do?
Did you know I read an article today or the other day that dolphins actually give each other names and that they have like they make whatever noise that they make their dolphin noises like each dolphin has its own noise associated with it so they actually like talk to each other and instead of like saying like Ash and Matt it's like squeak 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 squeak.
Sometimes I think scientists are just trying to pull a fast one on us with dolphins and they're just telling us how smart they are and how they do all this mm-hmm. stuff. And really, at the end of the day, they just, like, swim around and they are assholes to everybody.
Yeah, I think they're trying to keep humans humble or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, well, there could be a really smart mammal fish out there.
Yep. We're not the smartest.
I think squirrels
are the
smartest. I'm
going to go ahead and quickly pick. I'm going to pick...
Wait, Hillary, was the Saints your pick?
Yeah, they go marching in.
Because they go marching in. I got it.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to pick the Saints as well.
Okay.
What?
I can't stand. The Dolphins have like the worst logo in the history of football. It's like an aqua blue dolphin with like a sunburst behind it. It actually physically makes me like convulse when I look at it.
It's what I think of when I think of Florida, though.
That, no.
Oh, really? Is it?
Just think of like crime and racism. That's what you think about.
Oh, really? Not Harry Potter land and dolphins?
No, think of crime and racism. But also, Saints Row is a great game. So
it is a great game.
Okay.
All valid reasons. This is fine. Awesome. Well, it looks like, again, we could have a winner coming out of this. You guys split a couple picks. So we'll see what happens in the Nerd Appropriate Pick'em League next week.
All right, guys, thank you for tuning in to episode 122 of the Rated NA podcast. As always, you can find us on Twitter at Nerd Appropriate. You can email us directly, and that is Matt, Hillary with one L, Scott, and Ash at nerdappropriate.com. If you send us an email, Scott will actually use the new track he has been writing for our email section.
Oh, my God. No one's heard it yet. Email us something fun because Scott made this mailbag soundtrack. That is amazing.
It's amazing. So definitely send us an email with anything you want in it, especially send the bad ones to Hillary.
And get your votes in about what you want the loser or the winner of the Nerd Appropriate Pick'em League to get or lose.
Yeah. That'd be bad. But anyway, we're also on Facebook/Nerd Appropriate, and we will see you guys next week.
Yeah.
See you everyone. Week. Bye, Scott.
Just so I'm not a fat elf kid.